It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the rest of the program today, we're going to have the latest conversation in our series on building a better democracy. This is a time of peril for American democracy. A significant share of our fellow citizens, particularly on the right and encouraged by former President Trump, have grown to distrust any election that does not result in their preferred outcome. And that's just one of several ways in which Americans are increasingly not operating from the same set of facts. My next guest says the root problem with American democracy, though, goes deeper than the troubled political leaders who nurture those maladies. Rather, he says, the problem goes to the roots of our very founding and the anti-democratic ideas that guided the men who wrote our Constitution and created the nation. But there is hope, he says, hope in the idea that America can become a more truly democratic country, in which we share responsibility for governing each other with all the risks and rewards that entails. Jedediah Purdy is the Raphael Lemkin Professor of Law at Duke University. His most recent book is Two Cheers for Politics, Why Democracy is Flawed, Frightening, and Our Best Hope. Jed Purdy is teaching during our live show today, so I spoke with him earlier this week. As ever, we'd love to hear what you thought of our conversation. Email talk@21stshow.org. Jed Purdy, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Brian. I'm glad I could do it.
I want to begin, as you do in the book, with four possible history textbooks published in the year 2050. I guess for me, these are going to be read by my grandchildren, if I have any. They outline four scenarios for how the present moment and the coming decades are going to go. I thought maybe we could go through them, starting with the strong man.
Sure thing. So I'm trying to imagine four futures, and in each one, people may still think they live in a democracy, but they mean something different by it. And they're all sort of premised on the idea that right now, in 2023, we know we're looking at a period of crisis, democratic backsliding, climate disaster, inequality, financial market instability, and we don't even know what else. So each of the scenarios involves partly the question, does anyone save us? And if they do, who is it? The first one is the scenario where I say strong men save us. And what that means is the politics of a lot of countries, big and powerful and smaller, get taken over by figures like Trump and the Trumpist family and movement, like Narendra Modi in India, who's doing pretty well at it, like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's not, but not by much. And for each of them, democracy ends up meaning rule by the right people, our people. The world's very much an us against them world, very much a matter of zero sum grabbing for survival as things get tighter and harder. A real us and them. Who are the real Americans? Who are the real Brazilians? Who are the real Indians? That's what people around the world would mean by talking about democracy. Ours, not theirs. Second scenario is one where I say the experts save us. Politicians can't get anything done, but the central banks can. Investment bankers can, and to a certain extent, scientists can guide them. So if we do something about issues like climate change and maybe about global inequality, we do it through things like Federal Reserve initiatives and coordinated efforts of independent institutions across countries.
This is what I think the political scientist Samuel Huntington called Davos Man, right? The triumph of Davos Man.
Yes, that's exactly right. In some ways, the plausibility of that scenario turns on the fact that if you look back across the past 20 years, two of the great periods of political creativity and effectiveness have been central bank responses to the financial crisis of 2008-09 and then the incipient crisis at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And politics, in a sense, belongs to the people who can make things happen, particularly the ones who can master crisis. So in that world, what would democracy mean? It would mean something like the experts taking everyone's interests into account in an equitable way, but it would not mean that the people living with decisions would be the ones who had contributed to them. In a sense, we would be saying something like, well, we figured out in the 2020s that we can't live with that because the people get too many things wrong. So you need decisions to be made by capable people who know what the people need. The third scenario, Brian, is drift. It's what we're doing today, only so much more so. In this scenario, I imagine that there are basically red and blue textbooks, and they have different stories about what went wrong from the 2020s onward. But 30 years on, Washington can't really govern. Which states are nullifying, whether it's Texas or California, nullifying immigration policy or abortion policy or whatever, depends on who's in the White House. But it's sort of generally accepted that politics has broken down, nothing much has replaced it, crises are getting worse. And in some sense, we feel like we're living in the aftermath of a failed experiment, but we're not sure what can come next. This is the scenario where no one saves us.
This is the stalemate of tribal America.
Stalemate and deepening. Exactly. Exactly.
And all three of these scenarios, these first three scenarios, they're all extensions of our present moment.
That's right. We can recognize them around us now. And the last, and I guess that's what we're going to be, one of the things we're going to be talking about, is a scenario where we can somehow say 30 years on that we saved ourselves, that we deepened and preserved democracy in such a way that we took decisions together to face down the crises that we're in and came out of it better and stronger.
The first three sort of visions of America, the first three possible history textbooks you outlined, you, as we said, they're extensions of what's happening now. What is the present state of American democracy?
It's clogged and choked and confused, which isn't to say that there's not a lot in it that's worth preserving and trying to deepen. But let's start with a really quick couple of definitions, which we don't, and not everyone has to agree on, but we need to have a starting point. And I think these are important. We could say at a high level that the democratic idea is that the people who live with a set of decisions or rules or institutions ought to be the ones who decide on them. That is, the world that we live in, to the extent that it's possible, ought to be one that we've said okay to, even helped to shape. Then I think at the next stage, sort of making that more specific, since it's impossible for everyone to agree to a decision, the reason that we have to decide on how we're going, what sort of central banking policy we're going to have, what sort of climate policy we're going to have, and so on, is that we don't agree and we can't do it spontaneously. Given that, the democratic principle is that the decision of the majority is the best stand-in for all of us having agreed, for the people who have to live with the decisions being the ones who made them. So if we go with that, I think we can see that there are a lot of counter-majoritarian principles in the structure of American politics. The president isn't elected by a majority of voters in presidential elections, and that's had real consequences already twice in the 20th century. The Senate does not compose its majorities out of a majority of votes in Senate elections, and the Supreme Court, which decides the meaning unreviewably, more or less, of the fundamental law that's embedded in the Constitution, is in no particular way traceable to the judgments of we the people, of the kind that the Constitution's opening phrases announce as the basis of its authority. Now, I just said a bunch of things relatively in a relatively compressed way, and they're controversial. But I want to, the first point is simply, majorities don't really rule here. And in many ways, I think this is not to the good. The Senate's democratic distortions, which I was already describing, and its supermajority requirement in the filibuster have been major impediments to action on crises that we need to face. And the counter-majoritarian character of the Electoral College, the fact that you don't have to win the national popular vote to become president, along with the Senate's skew, has contributed, I think, to the viability of a minority rule strategy in one of the two parties, in the Republican Party. And it's I think, a dangerous thing for a democratic politics when you can run the country without having to appeal to or build a majority, but only mobilize a minority of votes with intense and scary feelings.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jed Purdy, who is the author of the book, Two Cheers for Politics, Why Democracy is Flawed, Frightening, and Our Best Hope. We recorded our conversation ahead of time, so we're not taking calls today, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. You talk about these sort of anti-democratic or less than democratic structure of American government. This was by design, though, right? So talk about what James Madison was thinking.
It was in some ways by design, absolutely. So James Madison famously said that one of the defining achievements of the U.S. Constitution was the total exclusion of the people in their collective capacity from government, meaning we don't vote directly in majorities on anything, legislation, the composition of Congress, or the White House. Everything is mediated through votes for senators, votes for representatives, votes for electors to the Electoral College, and so forth. Interestingly, Madison did admit that in principle, a people ought to be able to change their constitution, their fundamental law, by direct vote. But he had a sort of wonky argument that because the U.S. was partly a nation and partly a confederation of states, there was no constitutional people that could act directly in that way. Instead, amending the constitution had to go through the states in the way that it does now. You have to have three quarters of state legislatures sign on to make a constitutional amendment. What was James Madison thinking? He was absolutely thinking that majorities are not to be trusted. Majorities are headstrong, hot-headed, and they may be redistributionist and unreliable on economic policy. They may be too populist. Madison's examples of bad politics in the famous Federalist 10, where he talks about how you have to cool down and break up politics through representation, prominently include populist economic initiatives like paper money and the forgiveness of debts, which we're still fighting about today, easy money and the forgiveness of debts. But the other thing that I think is worth saying is our Constitution is incredibly hard to amend. This is one of the reasons our non-democratic features of government are locked in. And I think that's actually, Brian, to a greater degree than was intended. With a small number of states, the very high thresholds that we have didn't, in reality, the three quarters of states approving an amendment requirement, didn't in practice make it impossible to amend the Constitution. There were a wave of very early amendments. It's only with a larger number of states and with the kind of geographic partisan polarization that we have, the really strong red state, blue state thing, that you really lock up the Constitution so that the meaning of our fundamental law goes completely to the courts. So you're absolutely right. Madison is a very important representative of mistrust of democracy by the very people who are shaping it. And one of the things I write about in the book is the way that we live in a lot of ways in an intellectual legacy of mistrust of democracy, of anti-populism that's also anti-democracy. But at the same time, some of our institutions are more stuck and more anti-democratic, I would say, even than they were designed to be. And so even if you were a kind of originalist, you might think that the Constitution should be easier to change in a democratic way, in a democratic direction, than it effectively is now.
Well, there's a lot of directions I want to go from that in terms of the difficulty of rewriting our Constitution. I mean, we in Illinois are on our fourth Constitution in our state. Other nations have rewritten theirs. Maybe we can come back to that idea, because I want to stick with something else you said, which is you have a line very early in the book that you say it's easy to disbelieve quietly in democracy, to treat it as a nice idea, but one that, taken literally, would be impossible to achieve and dangerous to attempt. And you write that about people in the present day. And I certainly think you see that on the right with the idea that we don't want those people, right? Foreigners and people like that voting in our elections. You even see it on the left, right? In terms of the basket of deplorables and people clinging to guns and religion and a sort of distrust of the populace. But it goes back to the founding. Can you talk more about that disbelief, that quiet disbelief in democracy?
Absolutely. I don't know how quiet it was at the very beginning. It was part of Madison's argument in the Federalist Papers. But for a very long time, a lot of what we Americans have learned about democracy, how to think about it, sort of with the bread and milk of our civics lessons, has sort of been deeply influenced by the thought of people who really thought that democracy was, as you said, not really possible, and that we should not take the idea too literally for fear of falling down or hurting ourselves trying to do something that you can't really do. That was Madison's view. As we said, he thought it was essential that the Constitution not allow people directly to make decisions as majorities. So the idea that democracy isn't really what we do, what we really have is something like a common culture, something like shared civic habits that let us bump along, and that democracy is just the language that we use for it, it has in some ways a stronger pedigree in American life than any impulse to take democracy literally, which is to say that the most significant decisions ought to be actually traced back to decisions of majorities registered through open and universal voting.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, more from my conversation with Duke University law professor Jed Purdy. His latest book is Two Cheers for Politics: Why Democracy is Flawed, Frightening, and Our Best Hope. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Jedediah Purdy, who is a professor of law at Duke University. His most recent book is Two Cheers for Politics: Why Democracy is Flawed, Frightening, and Our Best Hope. Before the break, we were talking about one of the core ideas of his book, which is that we ought to be taking the notion of American democracy much more literally than we do now.
I think it would entail, for one thing, the opening up of the Constitution to change, because it is so, in so many ways, the institutional anchor of our non-democratic practices. I think it would mean a serious effort to think about, and I don't have answers to this part of the question, but a serious effort to think about the relationship between the role of experts and regulators in our government, from the EPA to the Federal Reserve to public health authorities, and political judgment. It's a very, very tricky one, because expertise is real. I think as well that if we're going to take the idea of democracy literally, we have to ask who's in the denominator, who's in the total bulk of people whose votes count. I think the principle of democracy clearly indicates that everyone who is living in a legal world and social world, which is, you know, part of what a country is, ought to be part of shaping it. I think that means that people who are or have been incarcerated, people who are non-citizens but making their lives here and living within our institutions, they are part of that we. So voting should be a universally open practice. Either there are a couple of ways you can think about it legally. I actually prefer to think that a democracy should make a fairly unconditional offer of citizenship to people who have been living within it and operating by, operating within it for relatively modest period of time, like 3 years. You could also think about shifting voting requirements from citizenship to residency. You see the appeal of that given how difficult citizenship is now and what a large cast of vulnerable workers and residents has been created by the fact that our economy relies on non-citizen workers. I actually think the idea of citizenship is a very powerful one and that it should be ideally expanded rather than undercut. But that's a sort of second order point. Everyone should be able to vote. Votes should count, and people should be able to see how their votes count, which is to say majorities should be the basic locus of decisions, and their vote should have implications for policy, and therefore the policies that we're living under should give us some indication of how we want to vote the next time around. And none of these things is exactly true in our confounded political system.
It may be a chicken and egg question that so few people are engaged in our civic life now, in our democracy, in the limited ways that they can be. How do you get people engaged when we've seen under our current system, people are not engaged in self-governance?
Absolutely. It's so important, Brian. Let me say, as I've been listening to myself answer your questions, I can imagine the skeptical listener who's saying, this is just some professor with a blueprint. These ideas may seem nice to him. They don't seem nice to me, but so what? This is just like imaginary tinkering with our institutions. So let me say something that's a little less about tinkering and a little more about political culture, about what Tocqueville called habits of the heart. I think Tocqueville wasn't wrong to think that culture is terrifically important to politics. I think one of the reasons this would be so hard, and I think I'm sort of coming at your question sideways, but I am going to sidle up to it and then look it in the eye, is that taking democracy literally actually means that the people we live with are making the decisions we're going to have to live under. That in one sense, we are one another's rulers, taking turns ruling and being ruled. I argue in the book that that's actually, that's not optional. The only question is who is doing the ruling, that is who is making the decisions about questions when we need someone to decide. So the democratic move is not to say that we need more ruling, but to say that we need to admit that there's ruling going on, governing is going on, and decide who should be doing it, and ask whether we actually trust ourselves and one another to do it. And I suspect that in response to that last question, a lot of people in their heart of hearts would say, not really. I look around and I don't really want these people, my fellow citizens, let alone everyone who's living in the country that this professor says should be able to vote, being my rulers. I'm more comfortable with some combination of the people in the Senate and the people on the Supreme Court. And I think the more our political culture descends into mutual mistrust, mutual alienation, sort of an assumption that if it comes from the other, quote unquote, the other side, it's always in bad faith. The belief that 90% of voters both supporting Biden and supporting Trump expressed early in 2000, just before the 2020 election, that if the other guy won, the country would suffer serious and lasting damage. You can't actually, I think, achieve deepened democracy in a culture where people find the idea of living under one another's rule intolerable. I think there's, under those conditions, there's always a lot of attraction to putting the decision somewhere else, because it at least takes it away from those other guys. So we have a real problem, because I think we are not very democratic institutionally, but there are also some ways that a certain like I would actually say a certain political courage, above all, a willingness to lose from time to time, even regularly, to the people you're living with, has sort of, if we ever had it, I don't want to be nostalgic, it's certainly weakened in favor of the idea that the other people are not fit to rule us. If we really believe that, then we're not going to be able to deepen politics, to deepen democracy. We're only going to be able to sort of talk piously about how democracy means what our side is for and not what the other side is for. And in some ways, that early sketch of possible futures is, among other things, a picture of what it looks like when just one kind of standpoint grabs the wheel and says, well, whatever we say is democracy. So what can you possibly do? I think to some extent, and I'll try not to take too long with this, to some extent, politics can sometimes create its own conditions for possibility. That may sound a little academic. Doing things makes more things possible. Great political experiments like the New Deal helped to sort of make a new political world that lasted for decades.
How do you get people to accept the idea that they're going to lose some of the time? It seems like American culture is so geared against that now, not just in politics even, but it's relevant to our conversation in the political context.
Perhaps, yeah, 100%. And I think that in some ways, the willingness to lose is the key discipline of politics. If you really believe it's intolerable for you to lose, then you're not ready to have politics with equals. And I think we see that so vividly in Donald Trump.
I think you would accept them when people would say, look, if I lose, you know, I'm not allowed to marry the person I want to marry, for example. Somebody else might say, if I lose, my father gets deported or something like that, that there are real life and death stakes. If somebody else loses, they feel their religion is under attack. Whether those are all true or real possibilities, people can argue about that, but the stakes are so high. Is that part of the problem as well, that everything seems like a life and death existential problem these days?
You put it really well. And I wouldn't want to take a thing away from the reality of the consequences. As you say, it's not abstract. It's people's lives. And I think everyone who's listening would agree that at least some of the three examples that you gave are real concrete possibilities. I would say we have to look at the fact that realistically any government can hurt us. There's no kind of government, there's no kind of politics that hasn't been dangerous to live under. I'm not saying that's like exciting or something, or that we should embrace it. Quite the contrary. I think it is the mark of a decent society and a decent government not to motivate people to harass one another, make one another's lives harder, engage in, you know, political wars to try to undercut or erase other people's identities and other people's ways of life. I just think that where we find ourselves facing looking at those fears, and you know, many of us to one degree or another either have or are one degree of separation from someone we really care about who has exactly those fears, or some others that feel like them. I don't think, all things considered, that there is a better place to look for a decision we can live with than to one another. I think for a while, liberals thought it was the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court, in a way, was going to get the principles right and limit politics and make politics more decent by making it more just. I think liberals are now confronting the fact that the Supreme Court is a political institution and has always been, and it's one that responds very effectively to minoritarian entrenchment and elite capture. The political right has recognized this for 40 or 50 years, and that's why they've been running a very effective institutional strategy to get control of the Supreme Court. And so the question is always, yes, this is not a game, and this is not easy, and this is not fun stuff, but compared to what? And I think we just don't have an alternative to be ruled by like benign philosopher kings, or to have some stabilizing authority outside of us that's going to make sure that we get the right answers and that we treat each other right. It's not the Supreme Court. It's not international human rights law. It's certainly not having the Senate and the presidential veto and the Electoral College in the political system. So we're sort of thrown back on looking to one another. And I think you have to hope in a way that if people really understand that we are in charge, that this is real, that a greater sense of responsibility comes with that, and that some of the politics of trolling and the politics of cruelty is a species of political nihilism. It's like a way of doing politics by people who in some ways don't really believe in it. I don't know that that's right, Brian. I'm not claiming to know, but I think it's the existential gamble of democracy that when people have the power to do more things together, they can develop a greater responsibility to do those things well and in a kind of humane way. You know, as individuals, we grow up and we realize we have responsibilities, and we become more serious when we realize that we are the adults and no one else is playing that role. And I think you could say that American democracy has had the idea that there are adults somewhere else in the Supreme Court, in the Senate, in the ghost of the Constitution, in the constitutional machine, and that those are all sort of defrocked right now, and it's kind of up to us.
Jed Purdy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show.
What a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you for really thoughtful questions.
Jed Purdy's book is Two Cheers for Politics, Why Democracy is Flawed, Frightening, and Our Best Hope. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.